You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. A big shout out to everyone who has signed up and subscribed to the new Snacky Tunes newsletter out on Substack. Super excited to see support from the community. And if there's any episodes that you'd like us to highlight or hear the story behind, please let us know and we will add them to an upcoming issue. On today's episode, I catch up with Chef Ryan Bartlow, who I met back in the days of Sam Mason's Taylor. And Chef Bartlow's restaurant, Ernesto's, was just recognized on Pete Wells' New York Times 100 Best Restaurant list. We chat about the current dining scene in the city, his formative years cooking in Basque Country in Spain, and the story behind the restaurant's iconic plates. And then from the archives, we share a chat and live performance from garage punk rockers Power Snap, who resided in Brooklyn but hailed from Tel Aviv and were there to celebrate their recently released debut EP. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
We'll be right back.
Ryan, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us. It looks like an absolute gorgeous spring day in New York City.
You're welcome. Yeah, it is. I got to say, it's a little cool, but it's very pleasant. So,
you know. Congratulations. 42 on Pete Wells' top NYC restaurants that came out this week.
Yeah.
How's it feel to be sitting in that, you know, that top 50?
Thank you. It feels great in the sense that I feel like it's I think Pete has really enjoyed and appreciated what we do here. Mm-hmm. He's been, knock on wood, I know he likes it here and has been favorable to us, but I think he understands our philosophy. But being on that list, more or less, is a great – it's good company to be in. I think he really painted a picture, more or less a landscape of you know, what his favorite restaurants are mm-hmm. or should be in New York, you know, from old standbys that are still relevant, like La Bernardine that was mm-hmm. up there mm-hmm. and, you know, newer places to the present, to what the future could be. So mm-hmm. It felt good to be paired in that list with, I think, a lot of other good company and a lot of places that I enjoy visiting when I have the time to go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a great, it's always good. He's put, you know, they put us on the best of the last couple of years, which has been lovely. And, yeah, I mean, you got to look at it like this. I mean, there's 50,000 restaurants in New York City. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. to be even acknowledged to be reviewed is great. I mean, sure. I have some good friends that I think do really good work that even haven't been reviewed for whatever reason. So
they're like, hey,
good or bad, you know, so to be recognized is great. And I think more than anything, it's always a great reminder of the work you do. It's good for your staff. It's good for morale. It's good for, you know, business. So it all helps, especially, you know, where we are, you know, in the state of things, of the dining scene right now. So, you know.
Yeah, I thought it was a good indication of where the New York dining scene is, of it mm-hmm. really being back, really there being community. I mean, I was in New York a couple weeks ago, and not just my experience, but it was like, good luck getting a reservation, you know?
Right.
Everything was full, every restaurant was at, and this list seems like the exclamation point on this, you know, post-pandemic return.
Right.
How does it feel as a chef and a business owner? You know, is that the truth? Is that just a little bit of marketing for, you know, the New York restaurant scene? Or do you really feel that, like, everything is back to as normal as it can?
I mean, I think someone would be lying if they said it feels like you know, November, December, 2019.
Sure.
Nothing feels like that yet. I mean, that was still, you try to, you post up in a restaurant, even when it's full, and kind of squeeze your way, and you're three or four persons back behind the bar, holding a drink and spilling it and talking to whoever you're with and hoping that eventually someone, there's moments where you feel that. I do think there's been a resurgence in kind of, people going out. At the same time, I know that people are being a little bit more wise with their money, because as the world's starting to open again, people are traveling again. I know that we felt it last fall, where it seemed like the first time in 3 years people were, last summer, were going away, like abroad, meaning Europe, you know, or wherever.
Yeah.
So people spent their money going to Provence or Puglia or, you know, Catalonia for 3 weeks, and then were a little bit, you know, hesitant as to when they were going to go out and how once October came around. And then November comes around, it's the holidays. And, you know, it seems like now things are good, but anytime it's a little slower, everyone's either making excuses or trying to track things in a way you never thought about. Like, well, the weather's a little crummy today. I don't know. We might get X amount of walk-ins, but let's prepare to put out the outside tables because it is nice. But also, it's 420 today, so maybe people are going to be this. And, last week was Easter, and then it was Passover, so we might get business. You know, it's like you're really thinking about things that I think you thought about, but not to – the level you do now and how you're going to then staff your team for the day. And yeah, it's everything. But overall, you're starting to feel, it felt good to be on that list, and you're starting to see parts of the city. I mean, I feel like there's the level of kind of, I don't want to say competition, but being recognized for doing good work is starting to come back, where it seemed like there was this moment of complete empathy for just any place that was open, good or bad. And you had to, you know, because look, no matter what people do, I don't think people understand what it takes to open a business and keep it going for longer than 6 months, whether you're in a pandemic or not. It's really hard. So I give anyone credit for stepping up and doing it, because it's not, it's very, very hard and not easy. So for anybody, but yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to where the city's going, and hopefully it's on a trajectory in a positive way, but still to me, and I think to many of my colleagues, it doesn't feel yet like it did, you know, 3.5 years ago.
Sure. I mean, speaking of the business of the restaurants, you got in really young.
Yes.
Like the teenager.
Yeah.
What drew you in? Did you always dream of opening your own spot, or were you just looking for an after-school job?
It's funny you say that. I think I was into food and restaurants by the time I was like 12 years old.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. I knew what good food was. I liked to... You know, I'd get out of school and literally hang out with a couple of my friends. And, you know, this is like the early mid 90s. And we'd go sit around in our friend's basement, put on, this is when the Food Network was just coming. I had another friend who was very into cooking. And so like even
that
more.
Helped.
Yeah. So like even more so than me, like his mom would, I don't know, like we'd be watching The Essence of Emerald. We watched Rolling and Chilling with Bobby Flay and Jack McDavid.
Classic.
You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, they'd say the presentation, the preparation, you know, whatever. Like, so there was always that. I grew up, you know, in Chicago, and I my parents knew about good restaurants, and occasionally we'd go to them, and they would take me out. And my father was an art dealer, and he had his gallery set up in a building that was still connected off Michigan Avenue through, you could get there through going to this building, and the other side was a really good Thai restaurant. And he used to go there every day for lunch. And I remember being 9 years old and being exposed to Lad Nar and Larb and Pad Sayu. And
this is the 90s.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Early 90s. And, you know, being scored calamari in a, you know, in a noodle gravy thing. And I was just like mesmerized. So I remember I'd asked to cut school to just hang out and go to work with my dad, which really all meant was he'd take me to lunch, you know?
Yeah.
So, I was always into food. And then I think naturally by the time I was 14, I started working at Baskin Robbins because I didn't really like school. So my dad kind of gave me an ultimatum. Like, look, you're either going to work or you're going to do, I didn't do bad in school, but I wasn't excelling maybe in the way I should have. So I started working when I was 14 at 31 Flavors. By the time I was 16, I was a manager there. And
there you
then
go.
Just kind of worked my way up into hospitality. And by the time it came time to more or less graduating from school, I really didn't fit in with the norm that people, you know, they were going to go to Indiana or Michigan or some Big Ten school or something. It just really wasn't for me. So the year before I graduated, there was a culinary camp that you could attend at Kendall College, which was a culinary school in Evanston, just north of the city off Northwestern campus. And I went for the week and I loved it. And I think at that point I was like, all right, I don't know where I'm going to go with this. I didn't even know if I wanted to be a chef per se. At that point, I was really into writing too. But maybe I'd be a food critic. So I said, okay, let's give it a shot. So senior year, I didn't have to like push that hard because I already knew where I was going.
Sure.
I was a teacher's assistant in home economics. And then right away in fall of 2000, I started culinary school. My first externship right about a year or halfway into school was working at a restaurant called MK for Michael Cornick, who was you know, pretty legitimate chef at the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he worked with Jerry Kleiner at a place called Marche, which is one of the original West Randolph, West Loop, you know, burgeoning restaurants and that whole scene, which is still there today if you go to Chicago, which is, you know, places have changed over and over, but it's still, it started back then. And, you know, you'd go in the mid-90s at, you know, 10 o'clock at night and see, you know, Scottie Pippen and Charles Barkley there after the Bulls game. It was crazy, you know. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And so I worked there, and I got to really work under the tutelage of people that he had running his kitchens. Like, the first person that ever interacted with was Eric Williams, who was the sous chef there, who now owns Virtue in Chicago. And he really helped me kind of get started and take me under his wing. Mindy Siegel was there, who's the pastry chef at the time, who now has, you know, all, she's had Hot Chocolate and Mindy's and all this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, won James Beard Awards. So is Eric, you know. It's funny. So all these people I've worked for have all been more or less Beard Award winners or Michelin star, or, you know, chef. So that was my start. And then right out of school, I stayed in Chicago and I worked for a chef named Carrie Nahabedian, who had Naha. She was kind of a legend already. She had worked for Jean Blanchet, Le Francais, which was a very famous restaurant in the 70s and 80s, just outside of Chicago at one point, considered the finest French restaurant or restaurant in the country. It was very, it was positioned very close to O'Hare Airport. So you'd see people fly in just to dine there and then leave in their jet or whatever. But
Must be nice work if you can get it. Yeah.
Yeah. She went on to be Norm Van Aken's sous chef at a restaurant called Sinclair's, which was, again, just north of the city. And one of her first cooks there was Charlie Trotter, you know, and he worked there. If you've ever, if you saw, what's the movie, Love Charlie, that came out recently about Charlie? Carrie's in it a lot, you know. She's interviewed in it a lot. She's a big part of it. So I worked there, and then, yeah, while I was there, I think everybody's drive at the time, if you could do it, was to try to at least do some time abroad. And I, while I started working for Carrie, I had also just graduated from school. And if you graduated, it, you know, with, I think, I don't forget, decent honors or high honors, top of the class.
enough honors.
Yeah, they would take you to the Bocuse d'Or, the biannual culinary competition in Lyon.
Wow.
So I was 20 years old and it was my first time going to Europe. And I was mesmerized. And I thought for sure I was going to work probably in France, because that was kind of the thing to do if you could do it. And I'd have to figure out how I was going to, you know, again, this is 2002, 2003. There's no DMing, there's no emails, there's no Facebook. Mm-hmm. You email, I mean, you can email, but it's like, it's not like now.
It's not like today.
No. It was very, very difficult to even communicate, let alone make a reservation. Still is hard to make a reservation. I mean, there's still places in Europe where you still have to call, you know?
I mean, yeah, Parlez-vous anglais, you know?
Yeah. So while I was there, you know, I went, there was a trade show going on, and there was all these cookbooks in one room and one book that really just caught me, and I was really captivated, was El Bulli, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I started reading about this place and about what was going on in Spain at the time. So I thought, okay, I'll see what they're about. Unfortunately, it seemed like their program, if you could get there somehow, was only 6 months. And I said, okay, well, if I'm going to go anywhere, I want to do at least a year. So
yeah,
it was my father that suggested, he's like, why don't you, you should look at, see what's going on in the Basque Country, because there's a lot of cool stuff going on there too. And there was this whole conversation about Spain going on in general.
Yep.
So,
which people forget now that Spain for a while, because so much has shifted to the Nordic part of the world.
Yes.
That El Bulli in Spain for years, if you're just looking at like the James Beard or Global list, they were leading the conversation.
You know, the funny thing was the conversation was led, but it was about this very specific kind of, you know, molecular and modernist cooking, which for me, which I'll get to, but you know, while you're there, but anyways, but I said, okay, you're starting hearing about all this Michelin stuff, and you're reading about San Sebastian, how it's still, I think to this day, has the most Michelin stars per capita of any populated city in the world. So I said, okay, you know, and my father said, look, if you really want to go, because we were trying, he's like, let's work this out, you know, because I got a pretty good deal for school and he helped me out, but I know he really wanted, if he knew I really want to do this, he'd help me. So I said, okay. So we flew to Madrid, rented a car, drove up to San Sebastian, went to a few places, and one was, you know, we went to Arzak, Muguriz, Akalar, sure, went to all the big ones, Versate, but I don't know what it was about Akalar. I don't know if it was the fact that they got back to me, or it was just...
That's a big part of it back
then.
Yeah.
But we were, you know, it's placed up outside the city on this gorgeous cliff that overlooks the entire Bay of Biscay. And we sat and had lunch, and I was like, wow, this is incredible. And, you know, Pedro, the chef, came out, and I just said, you know, in my more or less broken Spanish, Castellano, like, I'd love to work here. You know, I just came all the way here from Chicago. And he said, okay, yeah, return in 2 weeks. And that was pretty much it. And I just kind of stopped my entire current life and changed everything and went back. And, you know, and that became my life. So that was a big step, again, at a very young age, before I was even 23, working for, you know, a good restaurant. So
yeah. Well, listen, I want to take a quick musical break because I want to talk about your time there.
Sure.
And its continued influence and how it inspired Ernesto's. We have a quick song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are chatting with Chef Ryan Bartlow, who is the chef and co-owner of Ernesto's restaurant in New York. And so you're in San Sebastian, Spain, and we alluded to it a little bit before the break, but
right. Yeah.
When people think of Spain at that time, they think in foams, molecular gastronomy, and spherical things.
Right.
But that is a very specific part of cooking, which, and in many ways, today has really faded from what people would consider fine dining. I think
maybe
you see a little bit of the stuff that's hidden as technique, maybe xanthan gum or something like that. But that's not the food you serve at Ernesto's. And,
no.
I think what you were getting at before the break was that, like, there is this whole Basque culture of food and music and entertaining that really drew you in, which you can now really experience with your food today. But take me back to then.
Yeah.
What inspired you? What did you love?
Well, I think first of all,
what connected with you?
Yeah, I mean, it was the initial just engagement. I mean, not only the great part was, you know, when you go to these places at the time, what I liked about it was you had to be there for at least a year to do the whole program. And it was almost treated like school. You were not stuck in the dish pit. You were working about six different stations throughout the entire year in a beautiful dual island Multini, you know, very Michelin kitchen. They provide you with food every day at the restaurant. And then I was very fortunate where I got to live. Some of the cooks lived at this kind of apartment complex that they pay for down the hill. I got to live on the second floor of a 200-year-old family-owned Basque country restaurant.
That very nice.
Was very good. Like, really, really incredible. You know, it was, you know, so it was really, really interesting and very influential to be placed there. So I think at the time, you're going to this restaurant every day and you're seeing all these, you know, you're literally thrown right in. I mean, it's like, nobody spoke English. There was one or two other American guys there with me at the time. One happened to be my friend, he's a chef, and he's got a restaurant in Palo Alto now. His name is Tony Secviar. He worked for French Laundry for a long time.
Yeah.
He was my sweet. He had another bedroom there. He was there for a little while. I worked with him called Protégés. In Palo Alto. But either way, you're thrown right in, and it felt like an
amazing
old Michelin style kitchen. There were people from all over parts of Spain, Italy, Japan, France, but everyone speaking Castellano, which is the dominant language in Spain. So that's what we were speaking. And right away, my first day, I'll never forget, you're on an Amuse station. And yes, the techniques that you're using, there was some kind of seafood and borage, lecithin foam or something. But
sure.
It was the first time I'd seen in front of me, you know, incredible cockles that were flown in from Galicia, as well as razor clams. I'd never seen, you know, growing up in Chicago, we never had good seafood anyway. So, you know, seafood was like a big deal when my mom would go to, it was like a place called Burr Hop Seafood. We'd buy salmon that she'd bake soy vey like once a week, you know? It was okay. So, you know, this was like really incredible. And then you were exposed to these, to the product, things I'd never seen before. I mean, monkfish, sole, turbot, beautiful red, you know, carabinero shrimp, little white shrimp from Huelva, which is in Andalusia. So I think it was a mind-bending experience. But at the same time, when you're in it and you're just being told what to do, sometimes you're not realizing the reasons as to why you're doing these flavor profiles together. I mean, it was amazing to see all these ingredients being used because it was brand new and techniques, but I didn't necessarily understand why you're doing them the way you're doing them, which again leads to years later the kind of unearthing effect of understanding what this all meant as far as the culture, et cetera. But that said, there were two kind of more or less progressive tasting menus, but they still did offer at the time a very traditional like Basque a la carte menu, which had kind of the staples that you get all around town, where there was a hake and merluza and salsa verde, which is hake that's cooked in you know, fish fumet with garlic and parsley and white wine, percebes and squid and ink sauce and suckling lamb. So
cod fritters.
Yeah, we had only on Sundays we do croquettes.
Okay.
Yeah, again, so it was cool because
there were
days where they'd still like keep keep very traditional things. So Sunday, I think like a lot of places in Europe, lunch was the big thing. That's the main meal of the day. You know, around 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
We were closed. We were always closed Sunday nights and Mondays. So peak season when you're in, you know, when you're in Basque Country, because that's a very big tourist area, because beaches, surfing is huge there. Whereas the rest of Europe is usually closed around August, everybody's in San Sebastian. So it was incredible. I mean, just being a kid, being there at that time was awesome. So yeah, but like Sundays were a big deal. We'd cook for lunch and then we'd have Sunday nights off.
Nice.
And Mondays. And then in the wintertime, you'd get Sunday night, Monday and Tuesday. So you actually got 2 days off, 2.5 days, which was great because that would then give you the ability, if you wanted to, if you had a buddy that had a little Renault car, you could drive 3 hours to a totally different province.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Spain, or we'd get in a train and go to Barcelona for a night or two. You could drive. France is only 30 minutes away, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was this perfect kind of Bermuda Triangle of really learning how to, you know, I took every minute of freedom as an opportunity to learn, to see, to do. And I knew that I wouldn't have many moments like that in life that were just no responsibility other than showing up to a job and doing a good job and then being done. So that was, you know, that was basically it. So yeah, you're going through the motions and you're working in this incredible place. You know, we go into town sometimes. There were certain events where you'd shoulder up with people you meet from, yeah, some of the other big restaurants like Arzak and Mugaritz and yada, yada, yada. But I think over time, what was even overlooked that I noticed more as I went back was all these just incredible, good, local, seasonal restaurants that were not too far off from the place that I lived on top of, you know? I mean, you know, if you look at what's champion now, a place like Asador Echibari, which is known, that's really just a very, very, very refined version of the place that I, you know, lived on top of. I mean, the same ingredients, the steak, the fish, the little bit of salad with onions next to the steak, piquillo peppers, seasonal mushrooms, seasonal seafood, grilled properly on the grill, wine, bread. That's about it, you know?
I think what you're speaking about is just such a shift in dining culture. Now, we finally put it together. You finally reminded me where we met years ago, which was when you were working with Sam Mason at Taylor.
Yeah.
And that obviously that, you know, that trend of cooking came to the States and you put your teeth on it.
Right.
But in opening a restaurant now, what you've done with Ernesto is I think you're getting to the point of where so many of us who've been around for so long have sort of swung back to, which is like a very specific regional point of view.
Uh-huh.
And approachable, but like great ingredients, great techniques.
Yes.
And something that can also stand out because, look, you know, to maybe even your father's point being like, here's a restaurant you should look at. Here's a different point of view that you look at.
Yeah.
Because if you go to Lyon, Paris, London, Barcelona, you and every other guy who's or girl who's over in Europe is getting the same point of view. But like, look at the Basque region.
Yeah.
So how much of that was really in your back of your mind? Because you did come back to the States and you were a journeyman. You worked with a lot of – you worked with Linea and you were at Frenchette.
Sure. Yeah.
But how much was that always in the back of the mind working your way up to Ernesto's? You're like, I have this touchstone in my life and this is what I want to open up.
Exactly. With my restaurants. It was always in my mind. And I knew – and I knew I could do it, number one, because I understood it. But I also had my own story to tell about it because I was kind of this outsider looking in that eventually becomes part of it and eventually embraces it to the point where you're also a colleague within it, you know? But that takes a lot of courage, especially when you aren't from Spain. You had to learn another language.
Sure.
You're doing something that might be out of your quote-unquote wheelhouse. But it was always, you know, I'll never forget again. I mean, I give a lot, both my parents who are still alive, still together this day. I'm actually going to see them this weekend. They were big, big supporters. I remember when I first moved there to Spain and I was like, I don't know if I like this, you know, like, you know, at the time, just to even talk to anyone, you had to go into town and buy a little phone card and go to a pay phone booth and stand there and I'd call a long distance to my dad. It'd be raining and I'd be like, ah, man, this sucks. I don't know if I like it. Like, I don't know if I want to be here. And he'd be like, just, you know,
stick it out
because there will be a moment in time where you realize you'll never have this experience ever again.
Oh yeah.
And that made a lasting impact on me. And it wasn't that much longer, maybe 3 months when summer broke. The beach was alive. You get siesta, you get 3 hours off in the middle of the day to go do whatever you want. I got really healthy. I went to a gym and I'd swim every day and then walk around and you have a coffee, go back, you know, I felt really great. I had great friends. I got to travel to all these different places. There were so many festivals going on and yeah.
I mean, Spain in the summer.
Oh my God.
You're lucky enough to ever been, is magic.
It's magic. I mean, we got to go. Yeah. We go to San Fermín. We went to Pamplona. We would go to, you know, so many different, depending on the week, there'd be bullfights. There'd be, just constant. And again, San Sebastian itself is a very interesting town, very cultural town. They have an incredible jazz festival every summer. I saw Roy Ayers play on the beach there. You know, I saw the film festival there every year. In October, they have an incredible horror film festival. So all this cool stuff going on. So
how much of that culture and that perspective of life did you put into Ernesto's? Because you can easily just put the food in and be like, hey, we're doing this from the Basque region.
Yeah.
But how much was your goal in opening it to say, we're going to try and capture this region and bring it to New York?
It was 100% my goal. I really wanted to, relive those moments that I missed. I mean, that was the whole point. So it went well beyond, just the food. It was more about creating an atmosphere that in some way would give me a reminder of that time for the rest of my life. You know, I wanted something to make me feel like how I felt when I was 22, because you're never going to feel that way again, no matter where you are in your life, you know, that moment of kind of innocence, but you're also absorbing everything like a sponge. So for me, again, I think I took more in than a lot of my friends that lived there. You know, I had friends that would go back to their parents' house in Rioja on the weekends, or would go to Zaragoza, wherever they lived, because it was only about 2 hours in your car. So yeah, you'd stay still with you'd still have your bedroom in your parents' house. Sure. On those weekends, I was traveling. If whatever I could do, whoever would take me in their car, you know, if I could go to a friend's house and their mother would cook us a meal, that was incredible. So, you know, on holiday, my best buddy, he was from Andalusia, from Cordoba. So when we get like a week off or 5 days, he'd take me back to his parents' house in the southern part of Spain. And it was a whole totally different cultural experience than I had in San Sebastian. But so I think it went beyond just the food. It was those constant memories, reminders of doing something that I don't think a lot of people have done since or will do again. And like going back to everything, I knew I had somewhat of an angle in the sense that I still, to this day, there aren't a lot of people that are doing kind of individual, you know, Basque and or Spanish restaurants in New York, let alone in this country, you know, other than, you know, again, I think what Alex and Rage and Edard do is great.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Have people like Jose Andres, but that's a whole other thing, you know?
That's a whole other operation. That's a whole other thing.
That's the whole thing. So there, and again, but for me, I'm actually, you know, Edgar is Basque. I'm not. So it's like, I'm telling my story, which is different than theirs, you know? It's a reflection, I think, of my experiences and my time there, again, as this kid from Chicago, that it never left me. It never, ever left me. Even going on through all the things I did, that moment never left me. And it also helped me in a lot of ways climb the ladder as far as getting to where I needed to. I mean, as far as number one, learning how to speak Spanish fluently to this day, which I do, which again has helped me, I think, in advance and prosper
100%
in this field. And also, you know, it helped me when I came back to Chicago getting a job at Alinea. You know, that first roster, Grant was very selective of who he wanted, as he should have been. And if you look at that roster, I mean,
that roster is, it's a murderer's row.
To this day, I mean, yeah, I mean, I signed on, I was Alex Dupac's pastry assistant. So him, me, Jordan Kahn, John Shields, Curtis, Grant, J. Josh Habinger in Nashville. I mean, Greg that Backstrom, is. You know, it goes on and on. So, but again, I think by going to Europe and doing the thing helped me get that job, you know, because at the time, the majority of people that went over to Alinea were either from Trio, where Grant was prior, and there was a couple people like John Shields that were from Charlie Trotters.
Yeah.
And that was it.
So. Yeah. So looking back and, you know, now seeing the restaurant on the 100 New York list.
Yeah.
It seems like you've been able to, like, realize a dream that few chefs have been able to do. At a relatively young age, you know, some chefs never get this opportunity and you get to have this recognition.
Yeah.
And so I say nothing but congratulations to
Thank
that
you.
Because it's amazing to see, and especially knowing where you've been and what you've been through. The one last thing I wanted to touch on, which I've absolutely have loved seeing from far, is the plates, because I feel like the plates have the symbolic representation of what you've been talking about.
Yeah.
Because it's so bold to have your name on the plate, but it's also a bit of a nostalgic heritage type of plate as well.
Exactly.
What do those plates mean to you? How did the design come about? How do you feel like they reflect like the success you've had?
Well, again, I think that, like you said, the plates themselves, the emblem on the plate is kind of a reflection, an homage, you could say, to those kind of typical Spanish and or Basque taverns that really inspired the feeling of what this place is. But at the same time, even Acalara at the time had a little plate. You know, you remember even Danielle, you'd see little. So I never want to steer totally away. Like, people are like, well, you don't do anything like what you train. I go, yes, but behind the scenes, the methods, the recipes, the way I operate my, not to say I'm some Michelin kitchen tyrant, but there's practices. I mean, I think when I worked at Alinea, the one thing I gained more than anything was just how sanitary and smooth and just perfect everything was run. You know, I mean, there was no wasted minutes. So, but the plates themselves really reflect, I want you to know that you're escaping to somewhere else, but there's still a level of comfort and there's a story behind it. Because again, like a lot of places that might, a lot of places I went to, they'd write their name to kind of show who they are and represent their town, their village, but at the same time, I make the food that I would like to eat. And when I go to the restaurants now, when I was just in Madrid 2 weeks ago, and I traveled, and most of the places I went to were places that on the level that I feel are comparable to what we're doing here. I still have an appreciation for extreme fine dining. I also think that what we do to some people here is still considered quote unquote, whatever you want to call fine dining. But me personally, I'm not as enchanted with a 16 course Michelin meal anymore.
Who is anymore?
I think I want to eat really good product done well, but I don't personally don't. And I have total respect for anyone that wants to do it, but I'm more about less is more these days and just paying for something really, you know, of very high quality prepared the right way. And I think that's fair to say that, and I think we do that here. I think the great thing about what Ernesto's is we strip everything down to the bare core of what food, what service is supposed to be about. But still, you know, it is nice. We are that place where you can come in with a friend and sit at the bar and have a few pinchos and some croquettes, or you could make this a very special evening outing and your parents can come to town and you can get dressed up and you can buy, you know, two bottles of cava to start your meal and have a grand experience, buy a whole turbo and a big steak and really ball out, you know? And I think that's what a great restaurant should be. And you should feel comfortable doing both of those things without losing the essence and class of what I think New York meets Spain can be. And I think we've figured that out here, at least try to think we have. So,
yeah. Well, listen, congratulations. If people want to visit the restaurant or check out what you're doing, look at dishes, where can they go? How can they?
Easy. They can obviously go to ErnestosNYC.com. They can go to our Instagram, which is ErnestosNYC, or my Instagram, which is just DeBartolo. And yeah, it's very easy to find us.
You know, amazing. Well, it's so good to reconnect and to chat with you. Appreciate the time. And congrats.
You.
I'm looking forward to coming in next time I'm in the city.
Yeah, man. You got to come.
Shout out to Ava and Vanessa over at Mona as well for being just awesome. Setting us up. We have another song from the archives and a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm here with Power Snap live in studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi, Paul, you're going to have to shout since you're all back there.
All right.
Hi. Paul on drums.
Romy on guitar.
And vocals, or both vocals.
Yeah, she's like the lead vocals. Okay. And I'm doing some background things. I'm Noga.
Noga. So you're from Tel Aviv, or two of you are from Tel Aviv.
Oui. I'm from Ramat Gan. It's like a city next to Tel Aviv.
Fair enough. How far out?
Like 10 minutes drive.
Give it respect. Give it respect. Walking?
Represent.
Walking, it's like, depends 40. To which part. But
you,
it's walk, like,
you walked it
yeah,
a few times.
Yeah, it can
times.
Be like in 40 minutes, an hour maybe.
Okay. Growing up, what was the rock scene like in Tel Aviv? And what were your influences?
Small. Rock scene is small. Noga barely knows any Israeli music.
It's because my parents... No, I do know, like, but just...
From the 60s.
Israeli music in what sense? Like, traditional Israeli music? Like, contemporary pop Israeli music? Or?
Oh, that's like neither of us.
Oh, okay.
I mean, maybe a little bit. There's not a lot to talk about with contemporary Israeli music, I think.
Growing up, how did you get into this, or what were your influences, or where from around the world influenced the music that you play and got into?
Well, me, Romy, my dad is a musician.
What does he play?
He plays guitar and sings.
Okay. What type of music?
Rock.
Okay. Source?
Yeah. And Noga's dad is a musician, too.
Yeah, he plays bass and guitar, and he plays like rock and blues and stuff.
And
like
were
that.
They in? Did they do their original music, cover bands? What type of? Where did they play around town?
My dad had and still has a long career of like his songs and music.
What is it? Does he perform under his name, or what is it? A band or?
No, his name is Shalom Chanoch.
And what is his? And he plays around Israel, or what is his reception and audience?
He plays a lot in Israel. He comes, he tours the U.S. every like couple years. He's like a very big name, so he's like one of the reasons it was hard for me to like stay in that small little country.
Because there was personally. Because there was like there was no way it wasn't gonna be like a daughter of
exactly.
Right. So how did he influence you, and then how were you able to kind of define your own voice away from dad in the early days?
Well, I just grew up around music, and then I went to like an art high school, to the jazz department, where I met Nogi.
Yeah, friends from high school.
And since I was 12 and got to know Green Day, I wanted to start a band and move to the U.S. So when I met Nogi, she was a pianist, and and one day I got her to play bass, and then I was like, hey, we should do a band together.
Did you make a playlist since the rock scene was small? I mean, normally in the States, you'd be like, we want to be like, and then you list, you know, the wide, diverse range of influences that you could have from anywhere in the States. Where were you pulling from? And when you say rock music, who did you give as, you know, you used to have flyers like in the city, if you play this and these are your influences, we're looking for a bass player. Did you make a playlist? Did you like pass her some vinyl, some mixtapes, some
to her?
Yeah.
No, because she loves the Beatles, and that's all you need.
And so, what were your early shows like before you came? How long were you in a band, and was it always Power Snap? And then you came here, or were you a different band, and then when you moved here, you reformed as Power Snap?
So it started just from the both of us. We were playing like bass and guitar
like
in small
at cafes
yeah.
in Tel Aviv.
Yeah. In Tel Aviv. When we were like 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. And then
16,
right. And then what happened? I don't remember. We met like a couple, your cousin and his friend.
No, and then I was like, okay, I'm moving to New York, but I want to record some of my original songs. So when I move to New York and try to find a band, people know what, like, what my style is. Mm. So
and
I,
that was when you were like 17 or 16.
Seven,
never mind. When you like were that. Like younger and than today.
Yeah, earlier than today.
Yeah, earlier than today. And then I took Noga and I took my nephew, who's almost my age, and a couple of his friends, and we recorded like 3 songs. And then I got here and I was like, wait, I have a band in Israel, so I'm going to go back.
So did you go back and drag Noga by the hair or get on your knees and beg her to come? Or how did you end up?
No, I was like, yeah, I'm totally down to like try to move to a different country.
It took a few years, though, because I came back when I was like 17.
Yeah, I wasn't ready to move.
Yeah, you weren't ready.
I wanted to do like other stuff.
And then she met her boyfriend, who's also a musician, and then his bandmates from Israel moved to New York.
Easy
and then
decision.
He wanted to too.
No, it started from me. Started I was like,
me.
Yeah. Like,
but I mean, it started from me.
It started from you, and then it was me, and then I talked to him about it, and then it's. I think it's boring.
I think it's good though, just because you know, you just came with a couple of guitars, bass, and a dream, and what was it about hearing Green Day and being at the age of 12? Like, why did you want to come and make and release music in the States? What was the appeal?
I don't even know. I just remember seeing American Idiot, and I was like, what is this? I want it and also to be it.
And just something spoke to you about it. There was no something indefinable.
Something, it felt like very rebellious and very like, very emotional, even though it's like so angsty, you know? Like very... Yeah, it's angsty, and I was like a...
Angsty teen,
exactly.
And given the you know, the two different cities that you've existed in, Tel Aviv and New York, what would you say are some of the differences in people's reception to having the dream of being a musician, or the opportunities, or the availability, or New York versus Tel Aviv, and being like, I'm a musician, I want to be a rock and roller. How is it received?
Well, personally, I do feel some kind of like wearing out here, like getting worn out, because there's so much music and so many people. Even though in Israel, like in Tel Aviv, also every single person I know is an artist, but here, yeah, like all the music, it's kind of like too much sometimes, but also. I found here a community that really, like, when I fall, they lift me up. And I have Nogi and I have Paul, and we're together, you know. We help each other out. And that's something that was harder in Tel Aviv for some reason.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
So this is actually a song that started... we did have a band in Israel, and we used to call it Bar Vase, like a bar and a vase, but it's actually a mutation of the word barvaz, which means duck in Hebrew, and I really like ducks.
As you just waved your duck tattoo at me.
Yes, this is the radio, so it's good that you explained that.
Yeah. So here we go, Power Snap Live on Snacky Tunes.
Yes. 1, 2, 3. I
You mentioned finding community. You mentioned finding community here. I'm guessing it's the King Pizza world.
Yes.
Who's been so great to us and has sent us so many, 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 many wonderful bands.
We love them.
Yeah, we love them too. How did you find them and what spoke to them that pulled you in and made you feel safe, secure, warm, loved?
So this is actually a really funny story. Now, it's even funnier. Because, so I moved here. We moved here together.
What year was that?
October 2016.
Okay.
We moved just for the winter. Like, just for, like, the roughest time of the year. Just in time. And I was going, like, trying to go to a lot of shows by myself, which I've never done before in Israel. But here I didn't know anyone, and Nogi was busy with her boyfriend. So, and with, like, hating winter. So I went to shows, like, Googled, found Oh My Rockness, went to shows, blah, 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 Alphaville, all those places. Then one day I saw there was this band called Ghost King. They were playing at Alphaville. I went to see them, and Nogi joined me for, like, the first time. And I loved them. And after the show, I was coming up to the lead singer to tell him that I loved the show. And this other guy came up to him first, this bearded guy, who was asking the lead singer about booking a show, booking his band somewhere. And I heard, it was, like, right when, like, a month after we started Power Snap, before Paul is, like, we had one drummer before him who was Israeli, and then we were like, no, we need a local.
Jersey boy.
Joyzy. Anyway, so I later on spoke to that bearded guy, whose name is Greg. I was like, hey, I have a show. Yeah, book me. I was very nervous. That was the first time I saw Greg. And I heard about this, the Mad Doctors, this band, and they were having their, vinyl release a month later. So I went to that, and that was one of the most amazing shows I've been at in New York and ever. It was the first mosh pit I've been in the city, and everything was just so, like, loving and beautiful, and all the bands were amazing. And what's so funny about it, not only that we're in the King Pizza family now, is that Nogi plays bass for Ghost King.
Full circle.
Yeah.
And then some.
And then some.
Can we hear another song?
Sure.
What are you going to play for us?
We're going to play our song Chemistry from our EP that we released via King Pizza in the summer. The EP is named Delatency, and you can still get cassettes if you are cool and have a cassette player.
If you so desire. Before you play, the video is very good.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I've seen it. We encourage everyone to check it out. Who directed it, and what was the idea behind it? Who are all the people that are in it? There's more than three of you.
Right. Paul wasn't there because of his time. But by the time that we released the video, Paul was already the drummer, so great. That was kind of funny. Throwing his stick in the air in triumph. Directed and shot and edited it were Gal Shaya and Efrat Kariv, two of our very dear Israeli friends, and a couple other or three other of our friends were in it as my obstacles to get into the thing that I desire, that in the end is my demise.
I mean, well said.
Thank you.
All right, let's hear the song.
Radioactive visor, the stare.
Your EP came out earlier this year, Delatency?
Delatency.
Delatency.
Like delay and latency.
A new word.
Yes.
A new word. Where did
Greg, our friend from King Pizza, was like, before we released it, he was like, just making sure. You know it's not a real word, right?
They're like, it's not like some like Israeli translation where like, no, we're pretty sure it's a word. Or it's like, is this an Israeli word that we don't? Is this some Hebrew that we don't know? It's like, no, it's just a made up word.
No.
Where does it come from?
Delay and latency, because, you know, just everything's like always late, you know, like this EP took like 2 years to make, like those 3.5 songs. I felt like we moved here a little too late. We were always late when we like scheduled stuff with Paul. When we recorded the album, there was a lot of latency issues that we needed to solve.
You said 3.5 songs?
Yeah.
What's the half song?
Miscellaneous.
How is this song a half song?
Well, I encourage you. What?
It's like a mashup.
It's like, yeah, it's like a medley.
Okay.
Of like
interlude.
Weird demo thingies with some like skit bits. And yeah, I highly. We're on Spotify actually as of like yesterday or something. Yay! And yeah, please go listen to Delatency and tell us what you think about Miscellaneous. Was it stupid? Maybe.
Maybe. Probably not. Ha. Probably not. If you could message back to 12-year-old you who was into American Idiot and just had a dream of releasing music in the States, now that you've done it, what would you say to her and how do you feel about her currently?
Oh my God, I actually had a talk with her like, like a few weeks before my 24th birthday. And it was very emotional. It was very nice.
Tell us, set the stage for us.
I got super stoned and like, I looked in the mirror and the eyes there were looking, it was like my image, but the eyes there were looking back was me when I'm like 14, like 10 years ago. And I was like, Look where I am. Look where you are. And she was like, oh my God, this is awesome.
And then how does 24-year-old you feel about it now that you've done it? This, disregarding the fact that you moved here too late and everything's late.
Currently, yeah, I'm still not satisfied.
Still not satisfied. And why is that?
Because I want us to play in front of like 5,000 people, not 15 people. So come to our shows, help us.
I want to make sure we have time for one more song, but you're already on Spotify, but where can people find you, follow you, come to your shows, get yes. all the information?
When is this thing gonna be on?
Tomorrow.
Awesome. So come to our show in a few days on the 29th at Our Wicked Lady. It's Thursdays for the Cause, which means that all proceeds from the door and 10% of proceeds from the bar goes to, each month they pick a different charity. This month it's for this union to help voting rights, something. So that is cool. That is good. You should come. There's going to be special guests, maybe. And then also we're playing a show on December 9th with our dear, dear friends, Top Nachos, the band with the coolest name in the world.
Great name.
And yeah, we're on Spotify and stuff now and probably Apple Music, hopefully. I don't know. I'll check. You can buy our album on Bandcamp. You can buy the cassette on Bandcamp, too. And if you want a sick, super, super duper soft t-shirt with, like, double-sided one with stuff on the back and on the front.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Wow.
All sizes, either blue or white, come to one of our shows or, like, private messages or something like that.
Perfect. Well, we want to thank Sherry Bear for coming on, and congratulations on your 15-year anniversary.
Woo!
Power Snap, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you, Greg.
We will be back next week with an all-new episode of Snacky Tunes. What are you going to take us out with?
Pusher.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.
One, two, three, four. How much do I have to push you? Make you see me. How much do I have to clean up? Walk inside. Noble or in the mind, be cool man, or to take arms against the careless way of thought.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.